welcome to another episode of Audio Dust Jacket. I'm your host, Kevin Finn, and we have another great show for you today. First up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Shariet Elliott Urie with her two books, You Can Have It All, Just Not All at Once, and her other book, Ties to Tattoos. Welcome, Sherry. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So before we go into both these books, and they both look great, I just want our listeners to get to know a little bit about you and your background and why you decided to write these books.
Sure. I'm actually Canadian, and I relocated to the U.S. about 14 years ago. So I was in the HR field and loved working with people. I jokingly tell people my first degree was in accounting, and I don't even balance my own checkbook, which is absolutely true. So I decided people were something I were a lot more passionate about than numbers. And I've worked in a variety of HR roles throughout my time in Dallas and started my own business 7 years ago. And just listening to clients kind of made me hear a few messages that I hadn't really heard before when it came to why people weren't getting along. And so it kind of piqued my interest, and it kind of developed from there, and just enjoying the opportunity to hear what they had to say and some of the challenges in the workplace at that time, especially as I was developing my own HR consulting practice.
So what were some of those challenges?
Well, a lot of them were like, why do these kids have their pants around their ankles? And what's that shiny thing in their nose? And why are they showing up late? And, you know, at first they're like, they're just not looking at the policies. Now, they only say that when it came to the younger generation. And it was usually a boomer who was saying that, somebody who was more in their 40s and 50s. And it really wasn't a lack of adherence to policies, as I found out. It was more about a lack and of understanding and collaboration between two distinct generations that grew up in different times, have different values, different things have changed and molded them. And that really has been the differentiator, not that one generation has better work ethic than another. It's just they're all different, and they all, when you blend them together, really can be the competitive advantage for a company.
I love that, and I think you're correct in that that's overlooked a lot. So let's go into your first book, which I believe ties into your second book, You Can Have It All, Just Not All at Once. Tell our listeners
about
that.
My first book was Ties to Tattoos.
Oh, okay.
And we released it in 2009 and did a second edition in 2012. So really just listening to my clients and listening to what they were saying about their employee concerns. And that's what got me thinking. And I have a millennial age daughter and two millennial age stepdaughters. So I would like to think I could be somewhat of an additional expert because I've lived it. But I dedicated the book to my daughter. She worked for me when I was at Snelling as their vice president of HR and risk. And I fired her three times. Three times. She speaks to me now, thank goodness. She's 25. But then it was like, she'd be asleep at her desk. She would be reading in the file room. And so I just tell my staff, fire her. And I thought, why is a straight-A brilliant student not able to do what she's supposed to do and show up on time? And so through my conversations with her and my client, I dedicated Ties to Tattoos to her because she really also helped open my eyes to what our next generation of leaders are looking for and why millennials do things different than, for instance, me as a baby boomer, and to acknowledge that and accept it and find a way to work with it.
Well, let's talk just a little bit to the priorities of a baby boomer or a millennial, because I know they're quite different and people just don't really understand.
Right. I can say I believe we have generational DNA, which is our year of birth, so that could be like a baby boomer, but we also have our generational personality. So my year of birth, I'm more like a Gen Xer, but I act, my personality is of a baby boomer. So typically boomers are concerned about climbing the corporate ladder, the big house, the big title, you know, having that country club membership. It's all about me for them. It's the me generation and it's achievement. And what happened is a lot of the millennials who were born to boomers saw what happened to their parents when they got to the top of that ladder. They either were divorced, and boomers have the highest statistical divorce rate year after year, or they were laid off because they were old during downturns in the economy. So a lot of millennials went, do I want to value the same things my parents did? No. I want to enjoy my life. I want to have flexibility. I don't need to acquire stuff. I need to acquire experiences. So it's, I like to look at it very simply as boomers titles, and if you asked a boomer to move tomorrow, it would take them 6 months to get rid of all their material crippy crap things in their house, as I call it. But if you asked a millennial if they wanted a new opportunity to learn something new and move somewhere else, they're not as invested in the things as they are the experience and the opportunities that they get to learn from.
I love that. Also, aren't millennials more, they're more green-oriented about the environment, they're more family-oriented and friend-oriented. They'd rather their friends and family come first and their job come second.
Absolutely. Friends and family are first. That's why Facebook is so popular. And my stepdaughter the other day put her sonogram up there on Facebook before her dad and I got to see it.
Wow.
And I laugh because I'm like, they have 10,000 photos and their whole life is detailed on Facebook, including now her sonogram that her friends saw before we did. And it really is. That's how they stay connected. And really, millennials are sharing with their family and friends just through social media channels, and they're also spending time together. That's more important than climbing up that corporate ladder.
So how is Ties to Tattoos helping educate the older employee of how to really see the potential in the newer employee instead of writing them off and saying, well, that's a slacker, that person's not going to make it? How do we get that transition?
Yeah, really what the recipe was for this book was simple, was how to attract, retain, and motivate across all four generations. That was it. And it was, if you can attract them based on what they value, then you can retain them. And then finding tools to motivate them, which are going to be different. And it talks about generational cross-training. A boomer needs to sit down and share his wealth of knowledge and experience with a millennial, and a millennial can share some technology skills. So I really like to think of that development process between the two, especially as boomers are getting ready to retire. Millennials are our next generation of leaders, and they need that support. So I really talk about making sure from a company perspective, and even in a family, you need to value each of the different characteristics and use those to your advantage instead of looking them as a negative. And I also think we need a lot more coachable conversations. Millennials use that as a way to help grow, and I think a lot of boomers haven't taken enough time to do that with them. And so that's going to be really key as companies start moving in more millennials and their boomers are retiring.
Well, one thing I see with the millennial generation, and it's never happened before, there's a frustration with that technology gap, and it's the first time that the younger generation coming into a job, which they might not be as experienced at, but they have the technology down where the older generation has no idea about this technology at all. How's that affecting the workplace?
Oh, there's a huge gap when that happens because there's a lot of boomers who are resistant to updating and technology changes. They're almost to the point of being tired, whereas millennials embrace it. Now, I've had a lot of millennials I've coached that tell me I'm managing a boomer because they have the skills and they have the technology to manage and to run these departments, but they don't have the conversation, the communication, the management, the leadership skills yet. And so companies who put millennials in these jobs to manage boomers have to really be careful and make sure that they have a mentoring program or a coaching and development process for them to actually learn those skills. Because the art of communication is not something that millennials were engaged with. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of millennials grew up with Nintendo and Xbox, and that's a different type of communication than sitting down with someone and having one-on-one conversation.
What advice would you give the millennials now coming out of college, all these ones coming out of college right now, when they were going up in the economic boom, they were told, just go to college, get a degree, this is how much your degree is going to be worth. And now the millennials are coming out. They can't get jobs for that much money, but they have this entitlement that they should be able to do a limited amount of work and they should be able to get these big paychecks.
Yeah, I really recommend that a lot of our millennials, and I've given the same advice to our girls, is find out what you're really passionate about. So if it takes some time to figure out what you're passionate about, then be really good at it. So we've had our girls take Strengths Finder to find out what your top five strengths are.
Okay.
And then also, what do you really get excited about? Because the money will come. I firmly believe that. And people will be able to make a living off of whatever it is that they feel passionate about. But just telling our kids and our millennials, go to college, get a degree in X, and you're going to earn a good living, that worked for baby boomers. But it's not the same for millennials. The work environment's changed. They have a stronger sense of entitlement because boomers, as parents, gave everything they could to their kids mm-hmm. to make their lives easier. So I really think taking the strengths finder, finding out what you're really good at, what you're passionate about, and then going after that. A degree helps recruiters know that you finished something. You took the time and the energy and you followed through on a 4-year commitment. That's all a degree really does. Now that you have it, go figure out what you really want to do.
I love that, and I think that really goes with what you talked about with millennials. I have friends that have degrees in accounting and finance, and they're great degrees, but they absolutely hate accounting and finance. They only did it because they thought their parents told them, well, you'll be able to get this job, and they absolutely despise the job. Where can we find the Strength Finder you're talking about? Because I think that'd be really good for anyone to take.
Yeah, Strength Finder 2.0 can be found on Amazon or at a Barnes & Noble. I do a lot of Strength Finder training for mm-hmm. companies and DISC training, but I really do believe that StrengthsFinder is an inexpensive way for millennials to quickly read a few chapters, take the test online, and get their results. And then they can sit down either with their parents, coach, coworker, boss, and really figure out if they're strong in these areas, these top five areas, then figure out what some of the jobs are that are out there that you could apply those strengths to. Because we do not want to look at it as an area of challenge. We want to look at them as strengths, not weaknesses. So I really do believe that is a great way for a millennial just to get a head start on starting that process of, you know, what am I really passionate about? What do I enjoy?
So let's take that and let's transition to your next book, From Ties to Tattoos, and it really bleeds a lot into You Can Have It All, Just Not All at Once. And I think that's a good transition point.
Yeah, actually, I wrote the book within the first year after one of my very good friends passed away from breast cancer. And I had the opportunity to work with her at a client site. So I was very thankful for that. And she looked at me as she was going through the second round of breast cancer, and she said, I'm not done yet. I have a lot more left to give this world. And she'd been married 25 years, and both her boys had just gone to college. Well, she didn't make it much longer. And I looked at that statement that she said, I have a lot more to give this world. And I went, you know what? What does having it all mean? Because as boomers, we work to get to that all, and then usually it's like a mm-hmm. it's a cloud, and then we kind of go for more and more and more, and we're never satisfied, and we're running on this crazy treadmill that millennials understand isn't necessary. And so what did having it all mean? So I went out to a lot of my friends and other professionals, and I said, hey, what does having it all mean? Do you share your story? So throughout the book, a lot of them, 35 women, share their story of what having it all means to them at that point in their life and some of their trials and roadblocks that they've been able to achieve. But really, it's about what do you get excited about? And then put that energy into that and focus on enjoying having it all today, because you're not going to have it all every day.
I love that. You're partnered up with the Susan G. Komen Foundation, right? Also with this book or both?
Yes, actually both books. We give the profit from the sales from both Ties to Tattoos, and You Can Have It All to Susan G. Komen.
That is awesome. So, Sherry, what was the hardest part for you about writing these books, or did it come easy? Was it a natural process?
Ties to Tattoos was very easy for me, both the first and second edition, because I was very clear on what I wanted to share with the community and how passionate I was about the generational issue. When I did You Can Have It All, the 35 women were sending me stories. Some were so amazing and so moving and touching that I had to limit myself to how many I could read, mm-hmm. and I had to have my editor kind of field their way through them, and because they were so powerful. And then on top of that, it required, if they were going to powerfully share what having it all meant to them, I was now required to step up to the plate. And I have been somewhat of a private person, but unfortunately as an author and a speaker, that is, you know, taking it away a little bit. But
definitely,
the challenge that was put before me when I wrote You Can Have It All was you need to show up and be authentic and share your path of what having it all meant. And that wasn't easy for me to put that in writing out to the world and say, please accept this. So it was quite personal, and because I dedicated it to my girlfriend who passed away, mm-hmm. it was in her memory that I had the idea and the inspiration, and I took a year off and wrote the book. And so I'm really proud that all those women were willing to stand beside me and share their personal stories of success and failure and struggle.
That's very powerful and great. How can our listeners reach out to you and contact you and also get these books and support the fight on breast cancer?
Yeah, the books are available on ebook at Amazon and hardcover and paperback, but I can sign books and I send them right off my website, and that's the way I love to do it, so I can, you know, send people a little extra and their books get signed. So they can go to generationalguru.com and they can contact me. They can buy a book online, but if they want an ebook, they can absolutely go to Amazon.com and purchase it for Kindle or iPad. And we are just so appreciative that people are willing to listen to the message. And if they have a group that they feel like I could share the message with, whether it's generational or you can have it all, I do a lot of public speaking, both for charity and for corporations, on promoting those two messages.
Well, I think it's just a great cause, and the fact that you're giving all your profits to charity is just amazing and a godsend.
Well, thank you. Well, I feel very, very fortunate. Both my husband and I, when we got married 3 years ago, decided that's what we wanted to do. The books have made it possible for me to do what I'm passionate about, and so therefore anything that we get from it needs to go back to our community that's been so supportive of us.
And I love it. You're walking the walk. So
walking the talk. That's what I tell leaders all the time, because somebody's watching.
So, Sherry, thank you so much for being on. And if you write any more books, let us know. And we'd love to have you back on Audio Dust Jacket. This has been a great
interview.
Thank
you for having me and making me a part of your show.
Well, you have a wonderful day, and we hope to have you back on soon.
Great. Thank you.
Bye. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Byron Reese with his book, Infinite Progress, How Technology and the Internet Will End Ignorance, Disease, Hunger, Poverty, and War. Welcome, Byron.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on. I love the title of your book, but before we go dig into the meat of that, let's get a little background about who you are and let our listeners know.
Well, I run R&D for Demand Media. We're an internet publishing company with a number of websites like eHow, which is How to Do Everything, or Livestrong.com or Crack.com. And so I do R&D by day and a lot of evenings for Demand Media.
Awesome. Yeah, R&D, as we know, you never stop doing.
In an industry that innovates like the internet, if you even slow down for a breather, you get passed by. You know, it is just unprecedented, the rate of change.
Yeah, you take
that we have.
If you take 1 week off, you're way behind.
I know. You're done.
I think it's moving so fast right now. Even if you're constantly on it, you're falling a little behind as you go. So, but let's go into talking about your book, Infinite Progress. And I love the concept behind it. I think the internet is a very powerful tool, and it really can help end all this stuff.
Well, the basic idea of the book is that everybody knows about kind of Moore's law, that we get this doubling effect of technology on a very predictable basis. And what it means is that, you know, everything we've seen in the past, everything technology's created in the past 10,000 years, you know, doubles every couple of years again. And so what that implies is that problems which are fundamentally technological in nature, almost by definition, have technological solutions. And because of the rate of change of technology, we're going to find those solutions far faster than we kind of normally would think. And so I posit that ignorance and disease and poverty and hunger are simply technological problems. That's all they are. There's no inherent reason they have to exist. They just exist because we haven't figured out a solution for them yet. And so the book is really five separate books, because each one of them has kind of its own case as to why I think technology will bring about an end to that thing. And so the reader can start at any of those topics they find most compelling or interesting.
Well, the first one you mentioned is ignorance, and I feel like just with the mass amount of information that the internet and technology provide, that could help solve the rest of those. This could really lead into disease, hunger, poverty, and more.
Absolutely. And I even raised the bar, although it says ignorance. As I developed the concept in the book, I actually assert that every single person in the future will be wiser than anyone who has ever lived. And the way that happens is really fascinating to think about, and that is that the planet is getting blanketed in cheap sensors because they do all these things that we want computers to do for us. Like, you're going to have a camera mounted over your front door in the future that's going to scan everybody's face, that, you know, see if they're criminals who come to your door. And your skillet is going to remember everything you ever cooked in it. And your spoon will measure every bite you take and record all the calories and the nutritional value. And what's going to happen is something profound, which is that will, in essence, create something the world has never had, which is a collective memory. So for all of human history, we kind of learn something, then forget it. Learn, forget, learn, and forget, learn, and forget. If you learn something on one side of the world, it doesn't benefit me on my side of the world. And what's going to happen is everybody's life experience is going to go together to form this collective memory that that will inform everybody else's decision. So in every circumstance, almost, you will know the best possible thing you could do. Now, whether or not you do it is a different question entirely. I mean, many people start smoking every day, even though you know they know that might not be the best idea. They still do. But you'll at least have, based on data, the best information of the collective activity of all of humanity, a record of every cause and effect. And it will be profound. It will be profound to always know at least the best thing you should do. Everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll definitely exponentially benefit humanity as a whole. How are we going to get past the problem that I see right now is of the mass media and the news and how we have all this conflicting information where people over the internet can go find the truth, but a lot of people ignore that right now. How is that going to change?
Well, that's an excellent question, and you're right. You could say all that's going to do is actually increase the amount of noise. But I think what will happen is the internet right now isn't very good at sorting out accurate information from inaccurate information. It can't do that very well.
Not at all.
And, you know, you can post something on a blog that's true or not true, and the internet kind of can't tell the difference. And I think that's what's going to change. There are all kinds of people working on that problem that will essentially automatically fact-check anything you want them to, you know, everything. Every news story you go to, every sentence, you know, will have a number next to it, and you can click on that number or that link, and you could drill down as far as you want trying to verify that statement. And the internet, and, you know, and then you can see it'll turn things red that it thinks are fundamentally not true, and yellow, which are kind of sketchy, and green, which are verified. And so it's a problem yet to be solved. But the question is it a solvable problem, and is it a problem technology can solve? And I would strongly assert that it is. Now, there are all kinds of things technology can't solve for. I mean, there are just things that aren't at all technological problems, like, you know, envy or
definitely
gluttony or all these kind of, like, in the end, the great challenge is becoming better people. And technology doesn't actually help us do that very little. It helps us very little. But all these fundamental things that are technological in nature, we will see an end to. And it's so, the book, in my heart, I'm a historian. And because the interesting thing is we're reaching a point where we can do almost anything. If we set our mind to do it, we could do almost anything technological. And so the question is, what are we going to choose to do? And that is a question about human nature. And human nature, unlike technology, doesn't change. And so the only way to see kind of what people really do, not what they should do, say they should do, all these things, but what they really do is to study history. Mm-hmm. And then to study history and to say the future will have, you know, no hunger and no war and no poverty is actually an uphill battle because these are historic norms. And so, you know, I think my work was cut out for me in the book because I had to show why I think things are fundamentally different, why I agreed with Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, that in the future, you know, there will be no hunger and there will be no greed and all the children will know how to read. I believe that.
I think that's possible, and it's a great goal to aim for once we get past the mass media. You were talking about a smarter internet, an internet that could really differentiate between truth and lies and be able to tell you about that. Do you think with sites like Wikipedia, which have the human element in there, are they heading in the right direction, or do you want to head more towards a way to automate that and have like bots, as we have our SEO going right now, to sort of search the internet and find those things?
Well, I think both of those things are necessary. You know, I'm going to address that head on, but one of the fascinating surprises about the internet, you know, one of the things it taught us about ourselves, you know, I didn't need eBay to come along to tell me people want to sell the stuff in their attic, because people used to have garage sales. I didn't need PayPal to come along to show me people want to be able to send money, because you have Western Union. But I'm very interested in things that we built the internet to do that have no offline corollary. And like Twitter, you know, there is no offline Twitter. And those tell us something about ourselves. Like Twitter tells us things like the kind of information we want to share and the immediacy of it and all of that. And one really big surprise to me was the degree to which people were willing to help other people, total strangers, with absolutely no hope for, you know, any kind of compensation, reward, pat on the back, or anything. If you post some problem you have in some forum, you know, I'm going to Seattle and I don't know where to visit or something like that, people, total strangers, will post, take their time and post answers
Definitely.
To that. And what that tells us is that we have this innate desire to help each other that the internet enables. And so things like Wikipedia and the open source movement and Creative Commons are manifestations of that, of people with no hope of getting anything back are trying to contribute to the better good. But in the end, we have to realize that no matter how well-intentioned we are, no matter how smart we are, we're individuals and we are flawed. And that's, I think, where we kind of will use technology to help us, you know, shine lights on where we may not have been completely right, or our facts may not have been entirely straight, or our agenda may not have been completely transparent.
Mm-hmm. I think we're really fighting that battle right there with this new crowdfunding trend that's going on, because I think it's a great thing. I absolutely love crowdfunding. I've seen great things happen with it. And just the other day, I was watching a giant Facebook scam unfold, and I saw it, and I just saw how much money this person made within 4 hours of doing this. So that it definitely is an uphill battle.
It is true. I mean, nobody has to tell me the list of nefarious uses of the internet. But on the whole, we're building it to do good things. It reflects very well on us. We build it to share information, to collaborate, to offer mutual support, to connect with people we're fond of. I mean, all of these really fundamentally good purposes. It is unfortunate that a very small minority of people try to exploit that. But fundamentally, I think we're building the internet for good.
Oh, I completely agree. I believe the internet's really the last Wild West that we have right now. And right now there's government restrictions. We're having battles over the internet. I don't think people realize the scale that the internet is really going through a huge transition right now, and how it's going to really shape the world in the next 10 years.
It is something. You know, it still baffles me that somehow or another, in a world of 7 billion people, we have 6 billion cell phones. You know, that is just an amazing thing that when you go into a developing area and you offer them, the people there, any technology they want. Do you want better transportation? Do you want an air conditioner? Do you want entertainment? Do you want, you know, what would you like? People invariably grab the cell phone. And that tells us something very interesting about us, that the degree to which we want to stay connected to other people, the degree to which we want to be able to have people reach out to us.
So you obviously know what you're talking about. What do you want your reader to take away from these books? Who is your target who need to read these books, or is it for everybody?
Well, I would say this. I would say optimism is often characterized as a childish or naive or just childish viewpoint, you know, that kind of syrupy and saccharine and pessimist, you know, those are the people that's an adult position, you know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that is probably the one thing that will get us all killed, is that if we really believe the world is not going to be better in the future, or can't be better, because what happens is positive change is always driven by optimists, because they are the ones who believe the world's going to be better in the future, and they are going to, they're the ones willing to work for it. And if everybody all of a sudden believed, wow, you know, we've peaked, we've hit peak oil, we've hit peak this, and our children are going to have a lower standard of living than us, and we're running out of resources on the planet. When you start to be in that place, you stop working for a better tomorrow, and that
kills innovation.
Exactly. And so the book, I don't really hold a lot of hope. If you're vested in that pessimistic position, I don't know that I am going to be able to convince you out of it. But mm-hmm. I do want people who kind of in their heart say, I want to believe that this is true. And what I've tried to do is not make an emotional appeal for optimism, but an extremely intentional, kind of fact-based, carefully constructed, logical argument for optimism, so that someone who is inclined towards that position can read this book and say, okay, I don't have to, you know, take the taunts of my pessimistic friends that I, you know, am Pollyannish and have my head buried in the sand and, you know, all these other metaphors. So I guess it's people leaning towards optimism who want kind of the meat to back that up, because it's J. Craig Venter, the quote that opens the book is this by J. Craig Venter, and he says, I don't know if the pessimist or the optimist are right, but I know this, it will be the optimist who gets something done. And I just firmly believe that. You know, when the United States came out of World War II, it was this time that was obsessed with the future. In fact, the whole part of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you had the house of tomorrow and the car of tomorrow. You had John F. Kennedy in 1962, you know, people hearing him, there were people who heard him who were alive when the Wright brothers flew. And he gives this speech about, we're going to go to the moon in just 7 years on a spacecraft we haven't yet built, made out of materials that we haven't yet created. And it's all these technological hurdles, and yet he never implies it can't be done. All he does is kind of justifies why we should spend the money on it. And it was that kind of optimism that that gave us everything we have today. And by almost any measure you look at, over almost any period of time, if you look at the last 100 years or the last 1,000 years or the last 10,000 years, you pick any place in the world pretty much, and almost any standard, things are getting better. And that is our norm. Access to education, political, individual liberty, mm-hmm. Standard of living, like anything you look at, it has gotten better over any of those time periods.
Definitely.
And so our entire experience in human civilization is uninterrupted things getting better. And it's about to really, really get a lot better, because technology, what it does is it multiplies our ability to do things. You know, I can haul more bricks because I have a forklift than before I had that piece of technology. And because technology is about to just skyrocket in a way we cannot fathom, things are about to get massively better on the world. I posit in the book that it took us, 4,000 years to get from the abacus to the iPad, and in 20 years we'll have something as far advanced from the iPad as it is from the abacus. I mean, it's that kind of world we're about to enter into.
Well, people don't realize, but the biggest boom in America right now are small tech startup companies. They're doing some crazy stuff right now. We're not really talking about it over our news channels, but they're doing a lot of really cool things. Something that you mentioned that I love, that is why everyone should go, that if they're on the fence about this subject, should go buy your book, is logic. You said you wrote a logical book, and that's something I can get behind, where it's the facts. Here are the facts, decide this way or that way. And too many books nowadays are just written as some kind of propaganda or leaning one way or the other.
Well, thank you. I mean, I tried that. I had 8 years of debate in high school and college, and so I very much looked at it kind of through that. Like, what are the arguments for? I tried as much as possible to address as straightforward as I could all of the, all of the arguments I could think of against this position. I tried to deal with those head on, and I tried to create something that, there's something in the book to offend everyone. I apologize in advance for that.
That's human
because
nature.
The book isn't ideological. I don't have an axe to grind. So if you're a conservative, you're going to really be annoyed by some of it. If you're a liberal, if you're pro-business or pro-green or there's something in there that's going to offend you. And because I tried to look at these without an ideological bent, and I try very much to avoid policy implications. I just try to say, this is what's going to happen. And you apply your own set of values to it and decide what to do with it. But this is kind of the inevitable tide of history that we're about to face. What do you do when there is no more scarcity in the world? So scarcity is the central underlying assumption of all economic theory, is that there's only so many beanbags or baseballs or what have you, and some people are going to get them and some people aren't. What happens if that disappears. What happens if energy is free, absolutely free, free and clean, mm-hmm. that you can, I just try to outline what I think is going to happen. And then, of course, I spend a lot of time talking about, there's this sense of left behindness, that there are certain people that are going to be kind of left behind in this world, mm-hmm. This new world, that are going to be kind of the haves and the have-nots will continue to separate. And I try to address things like that head on, but again, leaving it to my reader to apply their own value mm-hmm. system to it. I just want to kind of give a glimpse forward and show that we don't actually believe, I think, that it's possible that there is a world with no hunger and no disease and no poverty and no war. It's just we can't get our minds around it. And so I want people to read this book and at least entertain the possibility that there's no reason those things have to exist. If there's been a day without war, which there has, and if there's ever been a year without war, which there has, there can be 2, there can be 10, there can be 100, infinite. There can be 1,000.
So how do our listeners reach out to you, and how do they get this book?
Well, I have a website, byronreese.com, byronreese.com. The book is on Amazon. Just type Infinite Progress. There is an audio version of it on audible.com as well. And I'm very easy to find online. I'm Byron Reese everywhere, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth. So I'm easy to find.
All right. Do you have a blog or anything that you
do?
The
website is basically that. It's called A History of the Future.
Okay.
And it's something I'm very interested in, which is how has our perception of what the future is going to be like changed over the years.
Okay. Well, I love that. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this book. I'm excited. I'm going to go ahead and go to Audible and go ahead and get a copy so I can listen to it on my drive whenever I drive a lot of different places and travel a lot. So thank you so much for coming on. And if you write any other books, we'd love to have you back on to talk about them.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Byron. Have a great day. Next up on Audio Dust Jacket, we have Dee Dones with her book, The Man with the Green Suitcase. Welcome, Dee. I didn't butcher your last name, did I?
Oh, no, it's perfect.
Okay, good. I think this is the first show I've made it through everyone's name. I normally mess up someone's name. So before we go into the book, I always like to just get to know the author, just a little bit about your background, why you're passionate about writing, and how you got where you are.
Well, I used to own a marketing company, so I do have a corporate background,
right.
You know, for more than 15 years. I've been marketing and branding. But I've always written, before I even got started with that, at age 20, I published poetry and did short stories, and I used to be a reporter many, many years ago, so I've always done some form of writing. Before I started my corporate journey, and I do a lot of charity work. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing that I'm passionate about doing. So I have a pretty diverse background.
Well, that's great to hear. I can hear the passion in your voice. So it seems like you're very passionate about this. Let's talk about The Man with the Green Suitcase. An interesting name, and tell us what it's about, because it's an interesting story. I want our listeners to really get to know the meat of it.
Well, The Man with the Green Suitcase is a paranormal mystery, and it's about an old man that comes into the lives of people that he gives visions to that come true. And some of these visions are good visions, some of them are maybe not so good, but these are things that the characters see that will make their lives change forever. And he's sort of like the catalyst he's unwilling in a lot of ways. These visions, they just come without him having any control over them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes place in Atlanta, Georgia, where I live.
That's where I live, too.
And, you know, he's homeless, and most people would look at a homeless person and would sort of think, not too much of the homeless, you know, the homeless guy, the homeless
yeah.
woman. And so he's this character that, is reluctant, but he gives these visions to people that come true. And there's Gerald, the corrupt businessman. There's Valerie, who is a prostitute that's trying to change out of that business. there's a corrupt business partner that's dealing with Gerald, and then we have a woman that was once beautiful that has been burned and wants to regain her beauty. So it's a very interesting cast of characters.
Sounds like a very interesting story, and I love the location, being an Atlanta boy, born and raised myself. So how do you create your characters? That's always something I love to ask authors, especially fictional authors. How do you create these just dynamic characters, and do they come from a piece of your personality, or everyone has a different method?
Well, I mean, the Man with the Green Suitcase started out several years ago as a poem that I wrote called The Man with the Green Suitcase, and so I had been trying to work on a novel like 2 years ago, and it wasn't quite gelling, the ideas and things like that. So one day, one morning at 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I said, aha, this is the story. I woke up and said, this will be the book, and then I wrote the ending of the book first, and then just started from the very beginning with the prologue and then chapter one. And in terms of just the character development, since I had worked many times in many homeless shelters, I just thought about, you know, what would, you know, it be like to have the central character be this homeless man. You don't even know his name until the very end of the book. You know, it just, you know, that character just spoke to me. And then in terms of the rest of the characters, you know, I've dealt with some shady businessmen before. So
definitely.
I was like, I've got to throw him in the mix. And then, like I said, just, you know, working, doing various charity things. I've met a whole host of people, including prostitutes and different other types of people. And I just find just, you know, dealing with characters that are flawed,
mm-hmm.
that's just so much more interesting than having just pristine characters because, you know, we all are flawed in our lives. So I just I wrote a very detailed outline, you know, giving backstory and personality traits and physical traits to all the characters. So I got to really know them before I even wrote the first chapter. I mean, when you do a really good outline, that kind of like makes the storytelling much easier. And you already know your characters. You're like right there mm-hmm. with them when you start writing the dialogue.
So do your characters like come to life really, and did they ever surprise you while you're writing this? I know a lot of authors will be like, well, this character's going to do this and that, and then you're halfway through the book and you're just like, no, they wouldn't do that, they're going this direction, you never expected it.
Well, you know, that's a very good question. You know, one of the things is when you do the outline and you have this clear vision, at first when I was writing Gerald, I was going to have him not so corrupt. But then when I dealt with my editor, Ann Fisher, she was like, oh, my gosh, you know, how in the world can he have a shady business partner and he's so naive? She said, you got to give him a little bit more color there and you know, put some, you know, put a little bit more things in there to make him show that he's, you know, not this goody two-shoes. So I had to go back and rewrite that character different from what I had in my outline. But everyone else was pretty true to what I had written in my original okay. outline. And of course, there are certain sections when you're going through the character development, because you trickle in, you know, the personalities of each character throughout the book, and especially for a mystery, you don't want to divulge too much of the characters right away because they're going through their growth. So you go in there and you may tweak certain things, but I never was really quite surprised. I mean, until when I read the entire book at the end, I said, oh, my gosh, this came from me. I can't believe I wrote that. It's like amazing that book, you know, was inside of me because, you know, none of those characters really mm-hmm. speak to my character, you know, how I live my life. But it's just amazing that you can create all these things, you know, from something that's totally different from what you are, your normal life.
Well, I think it's very interesting that you chose a paranormal mystery, which I think are awesome. But why did you pick that? With all the genres out there, it seems like it's easy to go with just a mystery or paranormal. And how do you decide to, like, mix those together? I think it was a genius move.
Well, you know, it was not something where I said, yes, it's going to be a paranormal mystery. You know, the book has a little bit of romance. It's a mystery, and it reads like contemporary general fiction, too. So it's a little bit of several things, but I grew up on Stephen King, so
I love Stephen King.
I guess that was settled, you know, into my writing soul. And then also, I'm a huge Alfred Hitchcock fan, and I'm a fan of the original Twilight Zone with Rod Serling. So a lot of people can tell that by reading the book. So I think that when you grew up on these things, you know, even if you think, oh, this doesn't affect the writing, it most certainly does. So I wasn't like, okay, great, I got to be, I knew it was going to be paranormal, but I didn't really think that I would be a mystery writer. Mm-hmm. But it just came natural to me. So the paranormal part, yes. The mystery part, I was shocked. I was like, okay, wow, this is a mystery.
That's awesome. What was the hardest part about writing this for you?
For me, I would say, because I tend to be a slow writer, and since, you know, my story is written in first person, that's mm-hmm. probably the most difficult way to write, as well as I had multiple point of view. So, you know, all the characters kind of diverge together. And, of course, the central character is the man with the green suitcase. And he's not necessarily the main character, but, you know, he is one of the central mm-hmm. ones. So it's hard to write that way. Most fiction books are not written with multiple point of view.
Definitely.
So I would say that was the most difficult thing. And then you have to balance that and not confuse the reader too much. And then to keep the mystery where you're not revealing it so soon. So those are probably the most difficult parts of writing a book, especially when you're talking about a mystery book.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you come from an e-marketing background. How are you marketing this book right now with that background?
I'm doing social media marketing. Also, obviously, I'm doing interviews, radio interviews. I'm doing a lot of guest posts, you know, not just about talking about my book, but also on marketing books, which is something that if you're a self-published writer is extremely important. Even if you are a mainstream mm-hmm. published writer, I was going to go with an agent, but I decided to do self-publishing since I have the marketing background. But, you know, there are so many different things you can do. I also run a free promotion group on Facebook for other authors, so we do cross-promotions for each other. Like I said, I write a lot of white papers on how to use social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and all the rest of those things to market your book. Because, you know, in this day and age, so many self-published books are out there. You really have to stand out. You have to put yourself out there and do your press releases, do your radio interviews. You need to do creative things on Facebook, hold contests and giveaways. And probably one of the most important things I did is when my book came out, I reached out to all the major book review bloggers because they're the ones that have the huge email list. And I sent out maybe 100 to 150 emails saying, hey, would you like to review my book? And so that helped. And I also sent emails out to some of the top Amazon reviewers to get people to review my book. And that's how I got tons of reviews. And, you know, my reviews are pretty good reviews. I got
I read some of them.
4.5 ratings.
Yeah, you've had a lot of rave reviews. So so how can our listening audience find your book and maybe your website and your contact information?
Well, you can go to ddones.com. That's DEEDOANES, ddones.com. Or you can go to themanwiththegreensuitcase.com. And I'm available on Amazon.com in ebook format as well as paperback.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Audio Desk Jacket today, Dee. And we'd love to have you back on if you write any more books.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, you have a great day.
Thanks.
That brings us to a close of another great show. I'm your host, Kevin Finn. And for everyone here at the Business Radio X family, we will see you next time on Audio Desk Jacket.